nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
So what I want to do today is just to go back and look at the Boltzmann equation again and talk about some things related to the Boltzmann equation, but not necessarily under near equilibrium, but even far from equilibrium. So here's the plan. We'll do a quick review. Then we'll look at solving the Boltzmann equation in equilibrium. And this may sound like it's not very interesting, but there actually is something fairly interesting there. And then we'll talk about solving the Boltzmann equation under ballistic conditions. And then just make one or two points, and then we'll be done. So let me just remind you, you know that in equilibrium, the probability that a state is occupied is given by this Fermi function, and we know all about the Fermi function, right? It goes from 1 to 0, and it's 50% probability of a state being occupied if it's at the Fermi level. If you look way above the Fermi level at that little tail, you know, then we can assume Boltzmann statistics. We drop the 1, and the distribution function starts looking like this. If I plot that on a logarithmic plot, it's just a straight line, and that refers to states that are way above the Fermi level. That's just the non-degenerate limit. Okay. So we know all about that. There's one thing I want to mention, though, and that is when you read books and papers and everything, you frequently see people not talking about the Fermi level, but talking about the chemical potential or the electrochemical potential. And they'll say that really, the electrochemical potential at T equals zero is the Fermi level. And at finite temperatures, it's really the electrochemical potential that we should be talking about. Now, it's kind of common in semiconductor terminology to use the term Fermi level under all conditions. So we talk about a temperature-dependent Fermi level. But if you read some books, they'll never do that. They'll be talking about the temperature-dependent electrochemical potential, which is equal to the Fermi level when T is equal to zero. All right. I don't want to use mu because we like to use mu for mobility in semiconductor work. Okay, so we're going to use EF. And I want to also just remind you, we could do this in K-space. If we have parabolic bands, then the energy is potential energy, which is the bottom of the conduction band, plus kinetic energy, which is given by the EK relation. And if we're parabolic bands, the EK relation is simple. And then we can write this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution as some prefactor out front that just depends on where the Fermi level is with respect to the conduction band. And then it's e to the minus h bar squared k squared over 2mkt. So if I plot that, you know, it'll look like this. And under equilibrium, it'll be symmetrical. It'll have a Maxwellian distribution. So when we're talking about Maxwellian distributions of velocity or in K space, then we just make this parabolic band assumption under non-degenerate conditions. So, you know, we'll be plotting these things from time to time. I just want to point out, remind you that the spread of this now is related to the temperature. Under near equilibrium conditions, the temperature of the electrons is equal to the temperature of the lattice because they scatter and they exchange energy, so they come into equilibrium. We're going to very soon be talking about high biases where you're far from equilibrium and the electrons might have a different temperature than the lattice. In fact, the electrons might not even have a temperature. And we'll see that in this lecture. So what happens out of equilibrium? So we solved the Boltzmann equation in part one of this course. And the way you can remember the answer is to think about the force on an electron is given by dp dt is equal to minus q times the electric field, where p is the crystal momentum. So if you apply an electric field in the negative x direction, you'll have a force in the positive x direction on every one of those electrons, and you would expect it to push the distribution to the right. Now, this is the displaced Maxwellian that we found when we solved the Boltzmann equation under small electric fields. Now, if we have a big electric field, we're just going to push it a lot further. But when we push it a lot further, we'll get a lot more scattering. And a lot of the kinetic energy will be not in the average velocity, which is right here, the drift velocity. Here now the average velocity is higher because the electric field has pushed it in K-space much more. But the spread is much more. And that spread is a measure of the random kinetic energy due to all of the scattering and everything. And, you know, so we have two things then. Now we have a displaced Maxwellian, but we also have a Maxwellian that is spread out in K-space. And we interpret that by saying that the electron temperature now is much bigger than the lattice temperature because the spread now is much bigger than it was near equilibrium. So these would be called hot carrier effects. Okay. And in order to find that red distribution, then we have to find F out of equilibrium. And we know that the way we do that is we solve the Boltzmann equation. And we've seen the Boltzmann equation. You know, we know how to write it down. We have this complicated collision integral that makes life a little bit difficult. We saw how to treat it with the relaxation time approximation, which frequently works near equilibrium. Okay. But now we're going to be very far from equilibrium, and we have to figure out what can we solve. And there are two ways that we can solve it. We can run a computer simulation, and we'll talk about doing that, or we can make some other assumptions, and we're going to talk about that first. Okay, so that's a review of what we discussed before on the Boltzmann equation. So now let's solve it under the simplest possible conditions as equilibrium, because we know the answer. We know that F is equal to F naught. But actually, there's an interesting thing or two to talk about. So here's our Boltzmann equation. Now, the collision integral, the part on the right-hand side, this is zero under two different kinds of conditions. It's under zero in equilibrium, because in equilibrium we have a lot of scattering going on, but we have detailed balance. If you scatter from here to there, it's precisely balanced by scattering from there to here at every single state. So the net effect at any state is zero. But the other possibility is that we're far away from equilibrium, but it's ballistic. There just is no scattering. That will also make the right-hand side zero. Those are two much different conditions. Okay, so let's talk about equilibrium first. And so we're going to solve the steady state. In equilibrium, nothing happens, so the time derivative is zero. And the collisions, detailed balance says there's no effect of collisions. So we just have to solve that equation. And we know what answer we're going to get, but okay, and this is just a reminder that the reason that the collision operator equals zero is because of detailed balance that holds in equilibrium. Okay, so let's solve this. So, you know, a way to solve any differential equation is to guess the solution and see if it works. So, with the benefit of hindsight, we can guess a solution. So let me guess some function of total energy, potential plus kinetic. So it's some unknown function. Of course, it's going to end up being the Fermi-Dirac function, right? But pretend you don't know. Okay. Potential energy, which is a function of position, and kinetic energy, which depends on momentum, or K. Right. So if I expand this out, I first of all have to take the spatial gradient of that function. So I take the spatial gradient of G, and then I have to take force dot the gradient in momentum space. So let's see. I guess the way we're doing this is by doing it with a chain rule. So I take the derivative of the function with respect to the total energy, and then I take the spatial gradient of the total energy. And then in the second case, I take the derivative of the function with respect to the total energy, and then I take the gradient in momentum space. And that's equal to zero in equilibrium. Okay. So now I can just divide these two out, okay? And this is the equation that has to be solved in equilibrium. Okay. So let's see. The gradient of potential energy is minus the force. So the first term is minus force dot velocity. The second term is force dot velocity. So indeed, what we've shown is that any function of total energy solves this equation. Now, we know from other arguments, usually you go through this in 606 to determine how you maximize probabilities in equilibrium, and you find that the particular total function that describes the electron occupation in equilibrium is the Fermi function. But mathematically, any function of the total energy satisfies that equation. Okay, so let's see if we can go a little bit further. We know the answer, right? From other arguments that you go through in courses like 606, you know that the right function of total energy is the Fermi-Dirac function. Let me write that as 1 plus e to the theta, where theta is just that argument. Okay. So now, if I go ahead and I plug that form into here and go ahead and do the differentiation, we can see what happens. And this is something like similar to what we did when we solved the Boltzmann equation. So I'll do the chain rule, df d theta times spatial gradient of theta plus df d theta times momentum gradient of theta. Okay. Then I'm going to divide out by df d theta because it's on both terms there. And then I'm just going to take the spatial gradient of theta, the conduction band edge. All right. There might be some band bending in the device, so that could have a spatial gradient. The kinetic energy only depends on K, so there's no space in that, unless the band structure is non-uniform, a heterostructure. If the effective mass varies with position, it gets a little more complicated. The Fermi energy, you know, maybe I don't remember 606 very well, and I don't remember that it's supposed to be constant in equilibrium. Let's assume that it might vary with position. And the temperature. All right, we don't know anything about it. Maybe it varies with position too. So when I go ahead and I do this differentiation in space, I have to differentiate the bottom of the conduction band. I'm going to differentiate the Fermi energy because I don't know. Maybe it's got a spatial gradient. And then I take this stuff, and E is the total energy now, and I take the gradient of 1 over temperature, and that plus F dot gradient in momentum. So I take F dot. When I take the gradient in momentum, there's no momentum in the conduction band. There's no momentum in the Fermi energy. There's no momentum in the temperature. There's only a momentum in the band structure. If I take dE, dP, I get velocity. It is a 1 over kT. So that's what I get just by expanding that out. Okay. And let's see. This is force dot velocity over kT. Gradient of the potential energy is minus force dot velocity over kT. Those two cancel out. So I'm left with this. That's the equation that has to be solved in equilibrium. And now, if I say I've got a conduction band that has a whole bunch of different energies, and I have to make sure that at every energy, this thing in the curly brackets is zero, then the only way I can make sure that these two go to zero at every energy is to assume that this term is zero and assume that this term is zero. Then no matter what the energy is, this thing will always satisfy the equation that it has to satisfy in equilibrium. So that's very interesting. You know, we've just proven that the Fermi level is constant in equilibrium, and the temperature is constant in equilibrium. Okay. So that's nice. So that's one thing that came out of it. Now, there's something really interesting. This is the way I taught, you know, for many years, this is where I left the story. You know, but this is a Phys Rev letter not too many years ago. Very interesting paper. They pointed out that if you go back to this equation, you say, what if there is only one energy channel? Right? What if you have a nanowire or something, or a molecule between two contacts? Then You just have to satisfy this equation at that single energy. You don't have to require that it be satisfied at a range of energies. Then it's possible to have a temperature gradient and a gradient to the Fermi level and still satisfy that equation. So in a case like that, you could be in equilibrium with a gradient in the Fermi level and a gradient in the temperature. You know? So, you know, even stuff that people has been well known almost that you don't even think about it for 40 years or so, when you start looking at things in a new regime, you very often find that things change. Okay. So you might ask, you know, why was the particular function of total energy, the Fermi function? You know, we saw that on the left-hand side, any function of total energy will make that side zero. But if you look at that collision integral, it takes a Fermi-Dirac function to make it zero. You talk about scattering, you talk about S of PP primes with phonons that are occupied by a Bose-Einstein distribution, then we require a Fermi-Dirac distribution in order to make that zero. So that gives us the particular function of total energy. All right. Pause. Any questions? Okay, so equilibrium, we knew the answer in advance, but even there, there's something interesting that happens. Now, this is an answer that we probably don't know the answer in advance. Let's assume we have a nano MOSFET or something that is completely ballistic and no scattering, and we apply a large voltage. If we apply a small voltage, it's near equilibrium transport, and we know everything about that. But if we apply a big voltage, what happens? Okay, now, it's scattering that makes life difficult. So it turns out that if I assume that it's ballistic and devices are getting small enough that you actually can start assuming that, then things become quite easy. So let's assume we have an energy band diagram like this. You know, this looks like a MOSFET. Here's the source, then there's an energy barrier, and you get into the channel. Here's the drain. Looks like we've applied a large drain voltage to pull the conduction band and the drain down. And let's assume that I have a big contact here. That's like my Landauer contact, where there's a lot of scattering. So there's a Fermi level that's well defined there. And that's my thermal equilibrium of reservoir that's just going to shoot electrons into my nano MOSFET. Okay, that's it. We have a well-defined Fermi level there. Now, I've also got I have a well-defined Fermi level, so I know what F is in the contact. It's my equilibrium Fermi function. Okay, I've got the same thing at the drain contact. Assume it's big, there's lots of scattering. It's a thermal equilibrium reservoir. The scattering maintains thermal equilibrium, so there's a well-defined Fermi level in the drain contact. It's just that if I apply a voltage, I've lowered that Fermi level by a lot compared to the other one. Under near equilibrium transport, this is a very small applied voltage. Now we're letting it be a very big applied voltage. Okay. But we're going to make a very important assumption. We're going to assume that the device is ballistic, right? There's no scattering inside the device. Okay. Okay. So we don't know what F is in there. We should solve the Boltzmann equation to find out what F is inside the device. Okay. Now, I'm going to have to assume that these contacts have some special properties, that they're reflectionless, and I'll talk about that a little later. Same assumption we made when we did the Landauer approach. Okay, so we go back to our Boltzmann equation, and this is exactly the same equation that we had under equilibrium conditions. All right, so that's a little perplexing. We're going to solve exactly the same equation, but we're nowhere near equilibrium with a volt applied to the drain. All right. So something different has to happen, and we have to figure out how that happens. But we know just mathematically, if you take any function of total energy and stick it into that equation, it'll be zero. You'll satisfy the equation. Okay. So we have to figure out what function of total energy do we put in there. Now, if we're going to solve that equation, That equation is first order in space. So how many boundary conditions can you apply to a first order differential equation? I know you guys know this, right? Did I hear one? But we have two contacts. All right? How can I only apply one boundary condition? Okay, so there's a trick. Here's how you do it. You apply half of the boundary conditions to the source, and you apply the other half of the boundary condition to the drain. And that turns out to be very physical. Because let's look over here at the source. Let me just force the positive half of the distribution to be an equilibrium Fermi function. Because I know there's an assumption that this contact is very, very close to equilibrium. So that's a very good approximation. These all have positive velocities. Those positive velocities, electrons get injected into the device with a positive velocity given by, this relation. Okay. That's only half. We've only specified half of F. On the other side, we specify the other half of F. The other side has a bunch of electrons in equilibrium. Some of them have negative velocities and get injected into the device. We'll assume that this is very near equilibrium too. So the half that gets injected in is an equilibrium Fermi function with a Fermi level of contact too. Okay. So now we've basically applied one boundary condition, half of it to the source contact and half of it to the drain contact. We're only specifying the incoming flux. And the Boltzmann equation then it's a well-posed differential equation when you specify the incoming flux from the two contacts. You can't specify the carrier density. Those of you that have used Centaurus or some drift diffusion program like that, that's what those programs do. At the drain contact, they'll assume that the electron concentration is its equilibrium value. And at the source contact, they'll assume that it's at the equilibrium value for the source doping. That's really non-physical. You can get away with it under certain conditions, but in general, it's non-physical because, when you go back to what you're doing, you're solving the Boltzmann equation, and you're only allowed to specify one boundary condition. Okay, now you wonder, what about the other? What if I go over here and I say, I'd like to know what the other half is? Well, you don't have any control over that. Because what happens is, some of these electrons come in, some of them bounce off the potential barrier, and they go back out, and give me the other half of the electrons at this boundary. That half is determined by solving the problem, right? We don't impose it. Now, if we are indeed very near equilibrium at this point, then this negative half is going to turn out to be very close to the positive half. Right? Same way over here. We don't impose the positive half. We inject electrons. Most of them can't get over that barrier because they don't have enough energy. They turn around and reflect back and come back out into the drain. Okay, so the other half of those boundary conditions are determined by the device and the applied bias, and they're whatever they turn out to be. We don't force them. Okay, so this is basically how we mathematically pose the problem. This is our collisionless Boltzmann equation. At the source contact one, we impose an equilibrium Fermi function with Fermi level of contact 1, but only for the positive momentum. At the drain contact, we impose an equilibrium Fermi function with the Fermi level of contact 2, but only for the negative momentum. And that's the mathematical description of the problem. So now all we have to do is to solve that equation under those boundary conditions. And that can be done, but it's a little mathematically involved. But we know that inside, the answer is some function of total energy. And we know that at the two boundaries, that function of total energy is a Fermi function. So in between, we can guess that the solution is a Fermi function everywhere. We just have one problem. We don't know what Fermi level to use. Because if I was inside contact 2, I would use Fermi level 2. If I was inside contact 1, I would use Fermi level 1. But which Fermi level do I use inside the device? Okay. So it turns out, you can just sit down and mathematically solve this problem. It's a little bit complicated to do, but it turns out that there is an easy physical way to see what the answer is. So you think about it like this. I've got electrons that just shoot in from contact 1, and if they have high enough energy, they just shoot across and they go out contact 2. If they have energy that's too low, like below the top of this barrier, they reflect off and go back out into contact 1. And I have the same thing in contact 2. Some turn around and come back out. I have to go way up in high energies, so there aren't very many electrons that have high enough energy to go all the way across, but some of them do. Now, if I can follow those trajectories through the device, then we can solve the Boltzmann equation. But here I'll get back. I told you that these contacts have to have special properties. And that is, when the electron goes into the contact, it's absorbed. It doesn't reflect inside the contact and turn around and come back out. It gets thermalized down into a Fermi Dirac function with Fermi level of EF2. So I call these absorbing contacts or reflectionless. And I have to do that, otherwise I can't do the bookkeeping. Like when this doesn't happen, then I know that if I look at this point here, if I have a positive velocity, it came from the source. If I have a negative velocity, it didn't come from the source, it came from the drain, as long as this kind of thing doesn't happen. So it means I can go through every state in the device and I know where it came from if I don't permit the contacts to reflect. So we just rule that out. And that turns out to be a pretty good approximation for most realistic contacts. Not always, people worry about it a little bit in nano devices. You have to worry if you've got a special problem. Okay, so here. So what we've concluded is that within the device, the probability that any state inside the device is occupied is given by an equilibrium Fermi function. Because that function of total energy will match up with what it has to be on both ends. And I've got to have one function that works throughout the entire device. The only problem is I have to figure out which Fermi level to use inside the device because there are two Fermi levels. The Fermi level, technically there is no Fermi level in the device. There's a Fermi level in contact 1 and there's a Fermi level in contact 2. But the answer is a Fermi function inside the device. And the principle is then you look in the device at some particular location, and you look at some particular state, and if the electron that's occupying that state came in from contact 1, then you use Fermi level 1. If the electron that's occupying that state came in from contact 2, then you use Fermi level 2. And because the contacts have these special properties, there's always only one answer as to what contact it came in from. Okay. Another way of looking at this is to say within a ballistic device, each of these states is occupied according to an equilibrium Fermi function. So each of those states is in equilibrium with one of the two contacts. Now, it's a funny kind of equilibrium because we're really as far from equilibrium as you can conceivably be. It's scattering that takes you back to equilibrium. There is no scattering inside the device. But in this limit, every K state is in equilibrium with one of the two contacts. Right. But we'll see that the overall distribution function doesn't look anything at all like an equilibrium Fermi function. So you see how this happens. So here's an example. So let's pick one location. I have two Fermi levels. I really don't have a Fermi level inside the device because the contacts are near equilibrium. There's lots of scattering that maintains near equilibrium conditions. A Fermi level is not well defined inside the device, but I'm just drawing them across that way. Okay, now let's look at the states at the top of that barrier. I could do this anywhere, but let's just start there. Okay, I'm going to assume that I have some band structure. So the kinetic energy is h bar squared k squared over 2m. And what I want to know is, how are those states, remember they're all spaced 2 pi over L, you know, how are those states occupied? What's their probability of being occupied? Okay. Well, electrons that come in from source 1 all have positive velocities. They can only occupy positive velocity states along here. They can't occupy these negative velocity states. So I would conclude that all of those positive velocity states, the probability that every one of those states is occupied is just given by an equilibrium Fermi function with Fermi level 1. Okay. You do the same thing with contact 2. Yeah. Now, all of the electrons that come in with energy over that barrier, they just flow out the other side, so they all have negative velocities. So the negative states there are occupied with an equilibrium Fermi function with a Fermi level of contact 2, which is, if this is a large applied bias, this is way down below Fermi level 1. So the probability that these states are occupied is very much less than the probability that the red states are occupied. But they're all occupied by the drain. Okay. So if you want to say, well, okay, what are the total number of electrons at that point? Well, it splits up into two ways. There are electrons that came in from contact 1 and occupied those states, and there are electrons that came in from contact 2. And if I want to compute them, you know, the way I would get the electrons that came in from contact 1 all have positive velocities. So I would just do a sum over the positive velocity k states of an equilibrium Fermi function with Fermi level 1. That would just work out that. That would give me all the positive velocity electrons. And if you convert that sum to an integral and do a change of variables to energy, you'll end up getting some, it won't be the total density of states there, because electrons that come in from contact 1 can't occupy half of the states. They can only occupy the positive velocity states. So it'll be a one-dimensional density of states at x equals 0 as a function of energy that are occupiable by contact 1. Right? These blue states are not occupiable by contact 1. It's just half of the states. Then times a Fermi function. Same thing if I want to know N2, I just do the sum over the negative k states and I use the Fermi level from contact 2. If I convert that sum in k space to an integral in k space, you know, I get a density of states occupiable by contact 2, which are just the blue states, weighted by a Fermi function with Fermi level 2. Okay, so let's see. You might also say, well, I want finer grained. I want to know what F looks like there. And if I look at the top of the barrier, remember in equilibrium we had a symmetrical Maxwellian distribution and no current flowing. If you look on the positive half, we have an equilibrium distribution that came in. So the positive half is an equilibrium Maxwellian distribution. Now, the negative half is also an equilibrium Fermi-Dirac distribution, but the Fermi level is much lower. So the probability that any state is occupied is much lower. So we have two different halves. We have a big positive half and we have a small negative half, so there's a net positive current flowing. Right. That's what the distribution function looks like. Now, in reality, things aren't going to be abrupt like that. There's going to be scattering that would wash things out. Probably be quantum effects that would give us some uncertainty in that too. But in a semi-classical model, that's the way we would draw it. Okay. So we're going to see this here later too. If I want the total number of electrons at the top of the barrier, I add up the ones with positive velocities and the ones with negative velocities. And it just means I get this Remember, in equilibrium, the way you get the total number of electrons is you integrate the density of states times the Fermi function. Here we have something that is almost the same. We integrate the part of the density of states that's occupiable by contact 1 and weighted by the Fermi function of contact 1, plus the part of the density of states that's occupiable by contact 2 and weighted by the Fermi function of contact 2. In this case, everything divides nice and symmetrically at the top of the barrier. Half of the states have positive velocity, half of the states have negative velocity, so each one of these is just half of the total density of states. Okay, let me pause. Is everyone with me? Looks easy. All right, let's think about one that's a little more complicated. I could go anywhere in this device. What if I go down here and say, what happens down here? So the same principle applies. If I look at any state anywhere, I just say, which contact did the electron come from that occupies that state? Okay. So you can see that there's kind of this, we have a semi-classical model. So we're not allowing tunneling through this barrier. So any electron that comes in with energy below the top of that barrier just gets reflected and turns around and goes back. So only electrons that come in with energy above the top of the barrier can occupy those positive velocity states. So now the states are not splitting in half. You know, the states that can be occupied by contact 1 are just those red states. Now how about contact 2? So electrons that come in with negative velocity states can occupy all of those. But electrons that come in from contact 2 with an energy below the top of the barrier, they're going to reflect off that barrier and turn around and become positive velocity states. So the positive velocity states here are occupied by contact 2. There are electrons that came in with a negative velocity, reflected off, and went back with a positive velocity. So you can see every state is occupied just by one contact. There's never any uncertainty as to where did the electron come from. If you have scattering, then it's very hard to tell what contact the electron came from. But when it's ballistic, it's nice and easy. If we want the total number of electrons at this point, you know, these states are just going to divide up, but not 50-50 now. Some fraction of the states can be occupied by contact 2. The rest of them, or contact 1, the rest of them are occupied by contact 2. Okay. So we would call this a local density of states. And there's a local density of states anywhere I go inside the device. You know, the states that can be occupied by contact 1 and contact 2 will change, but you can always figure it out easily. Try to do this in 2D. I don't know if there's an algorithm to do it in 2D. Okay. Now, if you look at the distribution function here, I'll just give you the answer. Maybe you don't want the total number of carriers. Hey, what did I tell you? Okay. So, let's say we want the distribution. Okay. So, here's how we would do it. Now, if I look at these blue states, electrons come in with a Fermi Dirac or Maxwellian distribution. The negative velocities look just like a normal Fermi Dirac distribution. The positive velocities look like a normal Fermi Dirac distribution until you get to this energy at the top of the barrier. And then there are no more positive velocities coming in from contact 2. All of the rest of them come in from contact 1. And contact 1 had a higher Fermi energy. So as soon as I go from below the dashed line to above the dashed line, the probability of a state being occupied is much bigger. So it pops up. Actually, it probably should pop up quite a lot higher. This we would call a ballistic peak. It's the very fast-moving electrons at the top of that distribution with high kinetic energy that are moving very fast. And here's a little exercise you can try. What if you look here and try to figure out what does the distribution function look like to the left of the barrier? So see if you can work that out. And here's an example. So this is a student of mine a few years ago who just wrote a little MATLAB script, and you just go through this energy band profile, and at every point you stop and you figure out which states can be occupied by which contact. And this is what the distribution function looks like. We talked about what it would look like in here. What it looks like in there is the solid, not too dark line here is just looks like a Maxwellian distribution. These are all the electrons that came in from contact 2 and turned around and went back out. But the peak that you see here, these are the electrons that are coming in from contact 1 and are just occupying these high energy states and moving very fast. So we would call those ballistic peaks. So you can go through and you can trace out the shape of the distribution function. And an equilibrium distribution function, looks like a Maxwellian, and it's got a standard deviation that's related to the temperature. This is made up of parts of two equilibrium distributions, but the overall distribution is highly non-Maxwellian. If you put these two together, that's the total distribution function. It doesn't look anything at all like a Maxwellian. There's no way to assign a temperature to that, really, because there's no Gaussian spread. The average energy is higher, but it's not. Sometimes people would say the average energy is 3/2 kT, and that's the way they would define a temperature. But, in principle, you only really feel comfortable about talking about a temperature when you have a Maxwellian distribution, when you have an equilibrium shape distribution. Okay, so this is a summary. You can do this under equilibrium, at least in 1D, pretty easily. The states always divide into two parts, one part filled by contact 1, one part filled by contact 2. And in 1D, it's easy just to figure out which part is which. And there are some things even in 1D that can go wrong. For example, what if you've got a quantum well inside your device? Electrons are just coming in from the contacts. Now, we would call these bound states. Somewhere inside the device, we have a quantum well, and we have, energy levels and bound states. Now, how do we put electrons in those bound states? If they come in ballistically, they're just going to zip across. If they come in from the contacts, they have to tunnel through, and these barriers could be quite wide. Right? The probability of them tunneling through might be less than machine precision. In practice, what would happen is that the electrons would come here and they would inelastically scatter and they would drop down in energy and they would fill up those states. So if we had situations like that, we'd be worried about our little algorithm, that we might be missing something important. And, those occur in practice, and you have to be careful. Sometimes people have special tricks they can use to do things that are approximately correct. Now, I want to connect up. In 606, the way you learn to treat these problems is, if you want the carrier density anywhere inside the device, you just integrate the density of states times a Fermi function, but you replace the Fermi level by the quasi-Fermi level. Okay. And the quasi-Fermi level makes a transition from the Fermi level in the first contact to the Fermi level in the second contact. Sometimes you can sort of guess what the shape of it looks like. When you have a forward bias p-n junction, you assume that the quasi-Fermi levels are flat. In general, you have to solve the semiconductor equations to find out how they work. But, this we would call diffusive transport. And this we can justify. There's an assumption when we're doing this. And the assumption is that there is so much scattering going on all of the time that at any location here, the occupation function looks like an equilibrium Fermi function. It's just that I have to replace the equilibrium Fermi level by this thing we call a quasi-Fermi level. To justify that, I have to assume that there's a lot of scattering inside the device. The scattering keeps F close to an equilibrium. There are none of these ballistic peaks or any of that other stuff, Then we can talk about a quasi-Fermi level inside the device. Now, when I talked about the ballistic case, you try to avoid talking about a Fermi level inside the device because it's not well defined. And you don't even need to talk about it. You only need to know the Fermi level in the two contacts. Okay, so then there's just one more thing I want to talk about to connect to something we've done before, so you can see another way of getting this Landauer approach. And we'll see if there's any questions. So let's say I have a resistor, and I'm going to apply a small bias. So we did this a long time ago. Let's say it's 1D. Let's say as a nanowire, I have some E of K that describes the electronic states in the nanowire. And I have a Fermi level in contact 1, and I have a Fermi level in contact 2 that's just a little bit different. Okay? So all of these red states are moving with positive velocity, so they give me some net current in the positive direction. And I can figure out what it is. It's just charge times velocity weighted by the probability that the state is occupied, summed over all positive k's. Same thing with the negative ones. I've got these negative states occupied. There's some total flux of electrons in the negative direction. I just sum over the negative k states, do the same kind of thing, but I weight by Fermi level 2, which is just a little bit lower than Fermi level 1, because I'm assuming near equilibrium. Okay. The net current, I have to subtract those two. And you can see that when I subtract this big positive red flux from this big positive blue flux, the only place I'm going to get a contribution is right in between where they don't cancel out. So what that says is that the only place that current is flowing is near the Fermi level. Right? Fermi level 1 and Fermi level 2 are in about the same place. Of course, you know, we've seen that before. So if you try to compute that current, the current is charge times the number of carriers times the velocity. So let's do it at t equals 0. So then we would call the velocity at the Fermi level the Fermi velocity. And they're about the same because these Fermi levels are close together, so they're about the same. If I want to know the total number of electrons flowing, just the ones here in this region that carry the current, it's the density of states per electron volt times the energy range, which is just EF1 minus EF2. It's only half the density of states because it's only the half that has positive velocities. I don't want to count the negative velocity states there. So I multiply the density of states in the positive x direction times the energy range times the velocity times charge, and then I say the difference in Fermi levels is just Q times the voltage, so I get a Q squared there. And then I remember early on that we had defined this thing that was related to the product of density of states times velocity. We called that the number of channels. And there was an H over 4 in front. So if I solve for D times F, and it's 4 over H times M, and put it in here, I get something that looks familiar. The current is 2q squared over h times the number of channels times the applied voltage. So the conductance is 2q squared over h times m. So everything we've done here is just another way of looking at what we did before. You know, in this case, we're solving the ballistic Boltzmann equation near equilibrium. We got the answers that we got before. Okay. Okay, so three main points I've been trying to make today. Any function of total energy satisfies the equilibrium or ballistic Boltzmann equation. In general, the equilibrium requires that the Fermi level is constant and the temperature is constant, you know, except in this pathological case of a nanostructure where, whoops, you can get some interesting things happening. And it's relatively easy to solve the Boltzmann equation, either near equilibrium or far equilibrium, if you're ballistic and if you're in 1D. Now, I don't quite know how to do it easily in 2D, because then you go inside the device and you try to figure out which contact populated this state, and it's much harder to do. You know, in principle, the same thing happens, but it gets a little harder to do mathematically. Okay, so that's what I wanted to cover today. Are there any questions? Yes.
So how do you get the conduction band profile that you show in
Yeah. So that's a good question. I gave you a reference, and you might have a look at that paper. I mean, basically what you do is you guess a conduction band profile. You solve for the carrier density at everywhere inside the device. You put it in Poisson's equation, and you get a better guess. So you just have to iterate until you get the right one. Yeah. So under ballistic conditions, it's relatively easy to solve these kinds of problems. The difficulty comes when there's scattering. If there is a lot of scattering, then you just solve a drift diffusion equation and things aren't very hard. You've done that in 606. But if you're somewhere in between ballistic and diffusive, all kinds of really interesting and tougher things to handle come about. And that's really what we want to talk about for the rest of the course. What happens when you have some scattering but not enough to use a drift diffusion equation? Because that's the case we're usually in these days with short channel devices and things.